Chapter 70. The tugboat was called the Pisto, after a Spanish dish of stewed red peppers, zucchini, and tomatoes. The name was appropriate, as her sides were streaked red with rust and her brass coated with verdigris. Yet, despite the neglect to her outer structure, the big 3,000-horsepower diesel engine that throbbed in her bowels was as bright and glossy as a polished bronze sculpture. Hands gripping the big teakwood wheel, Jack stared through the moisture-streaked windows at the gigantic mass looming up in the blackness. She was as cold and dark as the other two carriers of death tied to the docks. No navigation lights indicated her presence in the bay. Only the patrol boat that circled her 1,100-foot length and 160-foot beam served as a warning for other craft to stay clear. Jack eased the Pisto abreast of the Ozero Baikai and cautiously edged toward the aft anchor chain. The patrol boat quickly spotted them and came alongside. Three men rushed from the bridge and manned a rapid-fire gun on the bow. Jack rang the engine room for all stop, an act that was strictly for show as the tug's bow wave was already dying away to a ripple. A young lieutenant with a beard leaned out of the wheelhouse of the patrol boat and raised a bullhorn. "This is a restricted area. You don't belong here. Move clear." Jack cupped his hands to his mouth and shouted, "I've lost all power to my generators and my diesel just died on me. Can you give me a tow?" The lieutenant shook his head in exasperation. "This is a military boat. We do not give tows. Can I come aboard and use your radio to call my boss? He'll send another tug to tow us clear. What's wrong with your emergency battery power?" "Worn out." Jack made a gesture of helplessness. "No parts for repair. I'm on the waiting list. You know how it is." The boats were so close now they were almost touching. The lieutenant laid aside the bullhorn and replied in a rasping voice, "I cannot allow that." "Then I'll have to anchor right here until morning," Jack replied nastily. The lieutenant angrily threw up his hands in defeat. "Come aboard and make your call." Jack dropped down a ladder to the deck and jumped across the 4-foot gap between the boats. He looked around him with a slow, salty indifference, carefully noting the relaxed attitude of the 3-man gun crew, the mate standing by the helm casually lighting a cigar, the tired look on the lieutenant's face. The only man who was missing, he knew, was the engineer below. The lieutenant came up to him. "Make it quick. You're interfering with a military operation."
"Forgive me," said Jack slavishly, "but it's not my doing."
He reached forward as if wanting to shake hands and pumped 2 bullets from a silenced automatic into the lieutenant's heart. Then he calmly shot the helmsman. The trio around the bow gun crumpled and died under a flight of 3 precisely aimed arrows, fired by Jack's crew with crossbows. The engineer never felt the bullet that struck him in the temple. He fell over the boat's diesel engine, lifeless hands gripping a rag and a wrench. Jack and his crewmen carried the bodies below and then swiftly opened all drain plugs and seacocks. They returned to the tug and paid no more attention to the sinking patrol boat as it drifted away on the tide into the darkness. There was no gangway down, so a pair of grappling hooks were thrown over the tanker's deck railing. Jack and 2 others clambered up the sides and then hauled up portable acetylene tanks and a cutting torch. 45 minutes later, the anchor chains were cut away, and the little Pisto, like an ant trying to move an elephant, buried her heavy rope bow fender against the huge stern of the Ozero Baikai. Inch by inch, almost imperceptibly at first, and then, yard by yard, the tug began nudging the tanker away from the refinery and toward the middle of the bay. Pitt observed the slothful movement of the Ozero Baikai through a pair of night glasses. Fortunately, the ebb tide was working in their favor, pulling the behemoth farther from the core of the city. He had found a self-contained breathing unit and searched the holds for any sign of a detonating device, but could find nothing. He came to the conclusion it must have been buried somewhere under the ammonium nitrate in one of the middle cargo holds. After nearly 2 hours, he climbed to the main deck and thankfully breathed in the cool breeze off the sea. Pitt's watch read 4:30 when the Pisto came about and returned to the docks. She made straight for the munitions ship.
Jack backed her in until Moe's men hauled in the tow wire that was unreeled from the great winch on the stern of the tug and made fast to the Ozero Zaisson's aft bollards. The lines were cast off, but just as the Pisto prepared to pull, a military convoy of four trucks came roaring onto the wharf. Pitt dropped down the gangway and hit the dock at a dead run. He dodged around a loading crane and stopped at the stern line. He heaved the fat, oily rope off the bollard and let it fall in the water. There was no time to cast off the bowline. Heavily armed men were dropping from the trucks and forming into combat teams. He climbed the gangway and engaged the electric winch that lifted it level with the deck to prevent any assault from the wharf. He snatched up the bridge phone and rang the engine room. "Manny, they're here," was all he said. "I've got vacuum and enough steam in one boiler to move her." "Nice work, my friend. You shaved off an hour and a half." "Then let's haul ass." Pitt walked over to the ship's telegraph and moved the pointers to stand by. He threw the helm over so the stern would swing away from the pier first. Then he rang for dead slow astern. Manny rang back from the engine room, and Pitt could feel the engines begin to vibrate beneath his feet. Clark realized with sudden dismay that his small group of men were greatly outnumbered and any escape route cut off. He also discovered that they were not up against ordinary Cuban soldiers, but an elite force of Soviet Marines. At best, he might gain a few minutes' grace, enough time for the ships to move clear of the docks. He reached into a canvas bag hanging from his belt and took out a grenade. He stepped from the shadows and lobbed the grenade into the rear truck. The explosion came like a dull thump, followed by a brilliant flash of flame as the fuel tank burst. The truck seemed to blossom outward, and men were thrown across the dock like fiery bowling pins. He ran through the dazed and disorganized Russians, leaping over the screaming injured who were rolling around the dock, desperately trying to douse their flaming clothing. The next detonations came in rapid succession, echoing across the bay, as he heaved three more grenades under the remaining trucks. Fresh flame and clouds of smoke billowed above the roofs of the warehouses. The Marines frantically abandoned their vehicles and scrambled for their lives out of the Holocaust. A few were galvanized into action and began firing into the darkness at anything that vaguely resembled a human form. The ragged fusillade mingled with the sound of shattering glass as the windows of the warehouses were blown away. Clark's small team of six fighters held their fire. The few shots that came in their direction went over their heads. They waited as Clark mingled in the disorganized melee, unsuspected in his Cuban officer's uniform, cursing in fluent Russian and ordering the Marines to regroup and charge up the wharf. "Form up! Form up!" he shouted excitedly. "They're running away! Move, damn you, before the traitors escape!" He broke off suddenly as he came face to face with Borchev. The Soviet major's mouth fell open in total incredulity, and before he could close it, Clark grabbed him by the arm and hurled him over the dock into the water. Fortunately, no one took notice amid the confusion. "Follow me!" Clark yelled, and began running up the dock where it passed between two warehouses. Individually and in groups of four or five, the Soviet Marines raced after him, crouching and zigzagging in highly trained movements across the wharf, laying down a sheet of fire as they advanced. They seemed to have overcome the paralyzing shock of surprise and were determined to retaliate against their unseen enemy, never knowing they were escaping from one nightmare and entering another. No one questioned Clark's orders. Without their commander to tell them otherwise, the non-coms exhorted their men to follow the officer in the Cuban uniform who was leading the attack. When the Marines had dodged their way between the warehouses, Clark threw himself flat as though hit. It was the signal for his men to open up. The Soviets were hit from all sides. Many were cut off their feet. They made perfect targets, silhouetted by the blazing pyre of the trucks. Those who survived the scything sweep of death returned the fire. The staccato crash of sound was deafening as shells thudded into wooden walls and human flesh, or missed and ricocheted, whining into the night. Clark rolled violently toward the cover of a packing crate, but was struck in the thigh and again by a bullet that passed through both wrists. Badly battered, but still fighting, the Soviet Marines began to pull back. They made a futile attempt to break out of the dock area and reach the safety of a concrete wall running along the main boulevard. But two of Clark's men laid down a hail of fire that stopped them in their tracks. Clark lay there behind the crate, blood streaming from shattered veins, his life draining away, and he was helpless to stop it. His hands hung like broken tree limbs, and there was no feeling in his fingers. Blackness was already closing in when he dragged himself to the edge of the pier and stared out over the harbor. The last sight his eyes were to ever see was the outline of the two cargo ships against the lights on the opposite shore. They were swinging clear of the docks and turning toward the harbor entrance.